The book of Psalms, we go to it every now and then. As you guys probably know, it was the book of hymns that was written for the nation of Israel. And actually, the early church, this was their hymnal book. This is what they would be singing to each other in their church services. And it's really beautiful. The Psalms are really cool because they're very honest. They're very upfront. A lot of the Psalms are just straight up like what you'd expect to find in someone's journal. They're very, very in-depth about their emotions, how they're feeling, how they feel towards God. They don't really pull any punches or separate themselves into some weird, high, holy kind of verbiage. Especially the Psalms, we're not reading one of these today, but my favorite type of Psalms are the ones written by Asaph. That dude was awesome. He wrote a whole slew of Psalms called the Imprecatory Psalms. We call them the Cursing Psalms. We call him that because he was saying some pretty radical stuff about how he felt and things that would probably shock us, praying for people to get stabbed in the liver and, you know, have their family. Yeah, like that's, it was the death metal. It was the Christian metal of the day. In the heading of some of those Psalms, it says it's set to the tune, Do Not Destroy. That sounds like metal to me. So I don't know. So it's pretty sweet. You guys should look them up sometime if you're into that kind of stuff. Yeah, screamo. It was like the under oath of that day. Anyway, Psalm 1 is not one of those. Psalm 1 is cool because I think it is a really good psalm to introduce you into the book of Psalms. And he's going to lay out a couple things of why the Psalms are written and what they're supposed to do for us. So without going too much further into it, we don't know who wrote it. So usually if you look at the beginning of Psalms, it'll say like written by David or written by Asaph or written by Solomon or something like that. Psalm 1 doesn't start that way. So it's what we call an orphanic psalm. That's a cool word. It means that we don't know who wrote it, essentially what it is. A lot of people assume it's David, but the real important thing is what he wrote. Now listen to this. Blessed is the man who walks not in counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. His delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. The ungodly are not so, but are like chaff which the wind drives away. Therefore the ungodly shall not stand in judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish. So this psalm, what he's dealing with is he begins the psalm by saying, Blessed is the man. Do you guys know what blessed means? It means happy, right? It means happy. So what's the purpose of the Psalms? It's to make you happy. I like that. The purpose of the Psalms is to make you happy. It's to bring true, genuine joy and blessing inside of your life. It is happy is the man. And that's kind of a cool thing that I had to start to understand when I came back to Christianity. For those of you guys who don't know, I was an atheist for 3 years. When I came back to Christianity, I always kind of viewed God as kind of like a bummer, you know. It's like, you know, you should obey God because, you know, if you don't, you go to hell. But, you know, all in all, it is kind of a bummer to follow him. You know, you do have to give up a lot of the things that you like. You have to do a lot of things that you don't want to do. And that's just kind of the way it is. And it was kind of an interesting thing for me as I started to go through the Psalms when I came back. And I realized how much the psalmist genuinely loved, adored, and enjoyed God. And that was a perspective of God that I never really understood, especially when I was your guys' age. I never really understood that God was a God to be enjoyed, that he was a pleasurable God. Psalms like Psalm 16:11, in your presence is the fullness of joy, at your right hand are pleasures forevermore. See, that was kind of interesting to me, to think of God as a pleasurable God. And this is just something that, to think about in your own heads, inside of your own hearts. When you guys think of pleasure, joy, happiness, things like that, do you think of God? Do you think, man, like, I'm feeling kind of depressed today. I want to hang out with God because that guy is so pleasurable. Like, he's so enjoyable. Yeah, most of us don't think that way. But here the psalmist definitely does, because he's saying, dude, happy is the man who hangs out with God, who does these things. So obviously he found a lot of joy in it. So we're going to talk a little bit today about why is God enjoyable? How is he pleasurable and how do we engage in that? Now, first of all, he says what not to do. He doesn't walk in the counsel of the ungodly. He doesn't stand in the path of the sinners. And he doesn't sit in the seat of the scornful. So three things that a happy person doesn't do. You don't walk in the counsel of the ungodly. So this is the idea of actually listening to people who do not follow God, and doing as they do. So walking in the counsel of the ungodly. The second thing he says is he doesn't stand in the path of sinners, meaning he doesn't hang out in a place where a lot of people who don't love God hang out. He's not abiding in those kind of places. He's not hanging out with those type of people, and he's not listening to them and being led astray by them. And the last thing he does, he doesn't sit in the seat of the scornful. This is my favorite one. When we're talking about scornful, we're talking about people who are a mocking type of people. Right? That's pretty big in our generation. People who just like to make fun of things. They don't think that anything should be, you know, they just sit back and they just, I think Theodore Roosevelt, if you guys ever learned about it, he called them muckrakers. They're people who bring up a lot of problems, but they never bring up a solution. Right? So they just sit, man, the government's lame. It sucks. Well, what would you do differently? Well, yeah, it just sucks. You know, they have no actual positive solutions for government. They just say it sucks. The school's lame. Well, how do you think we should be educated? Well, you know, I just think it's stupid, you know, and then their ideologies are really always dumb. They're like, man, I think that we should all just live on farms and just share stuff. It doesn't make any sense. All right. That's completely ridiculous. So they're just people that just like to make fun of things. They have no actual positive things to say. They're not encouraging in any way. They don't actually have any good ideas. They just like to make fun of things. So I think that one's the easiest for us to understand. If you want to be a happy person, don't hang around people like that. That's very simple. If you want to be a happy person, don't hang around people that are always depressed and are always talking about depressing things. When I was in high school, I was a depressing person to hang around. You wouldn't have wanted to hang around me. I was a nihilist. Basically, a nihilist believes that the universe has no meaning or purpose. All of us are just headed towards death. And so you might as well just enjoy the little time you have left, because eventually you're going to be gone and no one's going to care. So that was how I looked at life. So obviously I wasn't the most cheery person to hang around. So you don't want to hang around people like that. You want to hang around people who actually have positive things to say, people who are encouraging. All right, it doesn't mean, this is important, it doesn't mean that we delude ourselves. Okay, sometimes when we think about things like this, we think about people who are just happy for no stinking reason. And those people are just as infuriating as the people that are angry for no reason, right? The people who are just like, man, everything's so great and beautiful. It's like, dude, do you ever get sad? Are you real? Like, are you a person? You know, those people are just cheery all the time. You just want to strangle them. Those are not the kind of people you want to hang around either. You want people who are real. Right? It doesn't mean we're happy about everything, but it means that we try to find good or optimistic things in any situation. That's what it means. So no matter how bad a circumstance in my life may be, whether I'm in school, whether I'm at work, whatever, there are always positive things happening inside of my life. And someone who is not a scornful person is someone who's always looking for those opportunities to be happy. Always looking for those opportunities to be happy. People who are scornful are always looking for reasons to be upset, right? Listen to the music they listen to. What's the music about? Life sucks, you know. I remember there was a band when I was in high school called Hawthorne Heights, and one of the lyrics in their songs was, slit my wrists and black out my eyes, and like all the kids loved that song, and I was like, really? You know, like this song? You know, this song about killing yourself and blacking your eyes out? You know, but that's just kind of, that would be someone who's scornful, someone who's just like, man, life sucks, this is gonna die, you know? So listen to the type of music that people listen to, watch the movies that they tend to like to watch. Do they like to watch depressing movies? They like to listen to depressing music, right? Are they always trying to bring themselves down? People like that obviously are not going to help you be happy. The other two things are a little more difficult to understand. Walking in the counsel of the ungodly and standing in the path of sinners. Now, that sounds very churchy. You know, it sounds very churchy. So if I want to be happy, I shouldn't hang around people who are ungodly. Now, that's weird. What does that mean? Who's someone who's ungodly? What we would say as Christians is we would say there's someone who doesn't want a relationship with God. That's what we would say. Someone who doesn't want a relationship with God. And the next one is standing in the path of sinners. So not only people who don't want a relationship with God, but now these are people who are actively sinning against God. When we talk about sin in the Christian life, that word, what it means is actually doing things against God. So not only do you not want a relationship with God, but you actually want to do things that offend God. That's kind of your deal. You like doing things that offend God. And he says, if you want to be happy, don't hang around people like that. Now let's think about why he would say that. As a Christian, what we believe is we believe that God, as the Psalms that I quoted to you guys before, God is the most pleasurable, enjoyable, beautiful being in the entire universe. Right? That's what we believe. So if I believe that God is the most pleasurable, encouraging, delightful, enjoyable, satisfying, incredible person in the entire universe, what could be better than hanging out with him? What could be better than having a relationship with him? Does that make sense? So if I have someone who doesn't want a relationship, if someone looks at God and he says, I know he's the most pleasurable, satisfying, amazing being in the entire universe, but I want nothing to do with him, is that a person who's really focused on their happiness? Is that someone who really wants to be happy? No. Now, they don't see it that way. Right? They definitely don't see it that way. They're not like, I know that God is the best, but I hate having the best things. I just want to be miserable. No one sees it that way. But as a Christian, that's the way we see it. We see it as God is the most pleasurable thing. So to have a to not have a relationship with him would be to go against your own happiness, would be to sin against your own pleasure, happiness, and satisfaction. All right, and now he talks about the positive things that this person does. So we're going to think about this in a relational term. Okay? His delight is in the law of the Lord, and in his law he meditates day and night. So when we're talking about the law of the Lord, we're actually talking about the first five books of the Bible. It's called the Torah. Torah. You don't need to know that because you're not Jewish, but it is called the Torah. And the Torah contains the law. It contains the laws of God. So that would be the thou shalt not type commandments. That's what we're talking about. He says somebody who is happy is someone who finds his delight, his joy, in studying the law. That's kind of an interesting sentence. Let's think about this. In our culture, in our society, we don't tend to think law as a liberating thing or an enjoyable thing, correct? In fact, a lot of us, I'm not going to sing, I promise, but I'm sure a lot of us have seen the movie Frozen, right? She's standing on the mountain. She says, no right, no wrong, no rules for me. I'm free, right? I didn't sing, I refrained myself. But that's kind of what we think about in freedom and joy and happiness and things like that. Where she's standing on in the mountain, and what is her freedom? Where does it come from? There's no right, there's no wrong, there's no rules. That's what freedom means. That's what joy means. No one tells me what's right, no one tells me what's wrong. I make up what I think is right. I make up what I think is wrong. And that is how I find my joy and my happiness inside of my life. That's a pretty common way of thinking today, isn't it? Now, I'm not going to go too deep into this, but think about this. The Bible says that true freedom, true joy, true happiness comes from restrictions. It comes from restrictions, which is weird. All right, now think about it this way. What if I were to tell you guys, as kids, what if I were to tell you guys, hey, if you want true freedom, don't try to breathe underwater. Now, did I just restrict you? I just restricted you to 75% of the world. 75% of the world is water. And I just told you, don't try to breathe underwater. I've restricted you. But what has that restriction done? It saved your life, right? So by restricting you to 75% of the world, I have liberated you to enjoy the rest of the world. Does that make sense? So restrictions can produce greater freedom and liberty if they're correct restrictions. If they're correct restrictions. If they're not correct restrictions, then they bring about greater amounts of pain, misery, and sadness. Okay, so if I were to tell you guys something that wasn't true, that restricted you. Like if I told you, if you eat candy, you will burst into flames. Now, I've restricted you, but that's not a correct restriction, right? I've just restricted you from something really pleasurable, and it's not even true. You obviously won't burst into flames if you eat candy. So that's a false restriction that actually brings about more pain and misery. Right? Is that kind of making sense to you guys? So in order for a truth to be both liberating, freeing, and satisfying, it has to be actually true to your nature. All right? And actually, a lot of philosophers throughout time found that to be true with a lot of their items. Okay, if I were to walk by someone and they were trying to, let's say, cook popcorn inside of a toaster, what would I do? If I really cared about them, what would I do? I would be like, hey, let me sit you aside. Let me tell you why your popcorn sucks. All right, it wasn't made for that. This was made to toast things, not to cook popcorn. Right? You've denied the design parameters for your device, and so because of that, you're destroying your product. Does that make sense? See, by restricting that person to the design parameters of the toaster to toast bread, I've actually increased and liberated them and brought them more joy and happiness. Here's what the Bible says. You have a specific design. You have a specific design. And that design is to be in a relationship with God. You were created for a relationship with Him. That's what it says. Now, you can either deny that, and you can say, well, there is no God, and I don't believe that. That's crap. You can deny that. But if you believe there's a God, you have to accept what the Bible teaches about Him. And the Bible teaches that you were designed to be in a relationship with Him. Colossians 1, verse 15. All things were made by Him, through Him, and the key word, for Him. You were made for Jesus. So if I go up to someone who's miserable in this world, I could say the same thing to the person that I would to the person who's trying to cook popcorn inside of a toaster. You want to know why you're so miserable? You want to know why your happiness seems to be taken away from you? You want to know why you always seem depressed? Why you always seem sad? It's because you're denying what you were created to be. You're denying what you were created to be. You were created in order to have a relationship with Jesus. That's what you were made to do. And the more you deny it, the more you're going to be miserable. The more you embrace it, the more you're going to be happy. The more you're going to find joy and happiness and satisfaction. Now, a relationship with Jesus is just like any relationship. Okay, imagine I'm married now. But imagine you guys who probably want to be married at some point. You want to date someone sometime. I'm doubting you guys are still at the age where you think other people have cooties, right? You guys are past that? All right, so you guys want to be in a relationship with someone. When you get into a relationship with someone, your freedoms will be restricted. I hope you know that. You can't just be like, you know what, I'm free, all right? And right when I sit down with the girl that I want to be with, hey, I want to go on a date with you, but just so you know, I'm free, baby, all right? I'm going to do what I want. I'm going to eat what I want. I'm going to say what I want. I'm going to remark on how I want. I'm going to do everything that I want to do. Being in a relationship with you is not going to change me one bit. How long is that relationship going to last? Probably not even after that sentence, probably, is actually how long that relationship would last. You can't do that. If you want to be in a relationship with someone, you have to restrict freedoms. There is a law that you enter into when you get into a relationship with someone. Does that make sense? There's things that I can't do. I can't look at Emma and be like, hey, you know what? I know we're married, but I also like other girls. That's cool, right? You know, because there's no law on me. There's a law on me. I could reject it all I want, but if I reject the law, I reject the relationship. Okay, here's the deal with God. God invites us into a relationship with Him, and He gives us a law. Now, me personally, I think that's the greatest news ever. Because here's the one number one thing you guys are going to find as you get into relationships with people. Finding out the law of the relationship sucks. Because you know how you find out what makes the other person angry? By doing it. And them getting angry at you. There's no other way. There's no other way around it. No one in the history of humanity has ever sat down with the person they're about to date and say, hey, these are all the things that make me angry. Just, I'm going to give you a list of them. Just don't do these and we'll get along fine. Nobody does that. They just assume you should know. They just assume you should know. So the second I do something that I didn't think was offensive, all of a sudden we're in a fight. Yeah. So that's the only way to figure out the law. And you better hope that you remember that fight. Because if you make the same mistake again, it gets progressively worse the more times you make the same mistake. So you want to learn the law. All right, God, I love the fact that God's just like, hey, if you want a relationship with me, this is what you do. I love that. That's so liberating to me. See how that's freeing? See how that's freeing? I want a relationship with God, so I delight, I enjoy His law. See, as a Christian, you and me should delight in the law of God. We should delight in it. It shouldn't be a bummer to us. We should never look at the law as thou shalt not. Oh, that's lame. God can't say that. That's wrong. Okay, so first of all, the law is given so that we know how to relate with God. But here's the second thing. God, this is unique to God. God created you, so He knows what's best for you. See, when you enter into a relationship with someone, the law that you enter into with them may not be the best for you. Right? It may not be exactly, but you give it up because you love that person. It may not be what's best for you, but because you want the richer, deeper, fuller, more satisfying bliss of romantic love, you will give up some things that you really, truly enjoyed, and there was nothing wrong with them. Okay? You may have to change what kind of movies you watch. You may have to change what kind of food you eat. You may have to, does that make sense? Certain things may change in you that weren't necessarily good or bad, but you choose it for the greater, deeper freedom of having a relationship. Here's the beauty of God. When He makes the rules for your relationship, the only rules that He makes are the ones that would hurt you. One pastor put it this way. He says, the things of the Bible are not forbidden. I mean, are not bad because they're forbidden. They're forbidden because they're bad. Do you guys see the distinction? One is God just saying, hey, you know what? I know that sex before marriage is a lot of fun. And it's going to make your life so much deeper and richer and fuller and better. But I'm a prude, so no. See, that would be one perspective. The other perspective is God says, I truly, genuinely love and I care about you. And so because of that, I'm going to say no to this, even though you really, really want it. So this goes into the idea that God is not only our spouse, which is kind of weird for some of us to think about. He's not only our spouse in that type of relationship, but He's also our parent. He loves us like a parent does. Right? Why do parents restrict their kids from doing certain things? Hopefully because they love them. Hopefully because they love them. Some parents restrict kids from doing certain things because they just like to do that. They like to be withholding. But some parents, hopefully, they restrict you guys from doing certain things because they know it will hurt you. Why did my dad, when I was 2 years old, grab me and yell at me when I was about to stick my hand in the fire? Because he knew that, hey, if I don't do this, my son is going to seriously injure himself. Does that make sense? It's not because he's a weirdo. It's not because he's like, you know what, I know that touching the fire would enlighten you and make you so much better of a human being, so I'm going to stop you. That's not why. He did it because he loved me. So I need to think of God the same way. God gave me certain directives and commandments because He knows this goes outside of what's going to be best for you. Now, I don't have time to go through this, but every single commandment that God has given, did you guys know that our culture and society has basically decided that everything that He said is right? Almost. We're at the precipice. There's only one thing that we kind of disagree with God on, and that would be our sexuality. That's the only thing. But the more and more that statistics are coming about our sexuality, the overwhelming evidence is that actually God's way of monogamous heterosexual sexuality is the best way. The overwhelming amount of evidence actually states that, but a lot of people just want to ignore it anyway. All right, so that's the only real thing. But I mean, when God says, thou shalt not steal, I don't really hear a lot of people in Congress saying, that is ridiculous. What an archaic rule. What a stupid law that I can't steal stuff that I want to steal. Nobody says that. When God says, thou shalt not murder, nobody's screaming in a classroom like, what? I should be able to kill whoever I want. What? Antelope do it all the time. Why can't I? That's ridiculous. You know, no one says that. The only real law that we look at and we disagree with God on a little bit is our sexuality. That's really the only one. The other ones we're pretty solid with. We're like, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. You see, Paul puts it this way in Romans chapter 2. You guys want to go there really quickly. In Romans chapter 2, he's talking about the law, and he says something very interesting about it. He talks about non-believers keeping the law. Okay, so the Bible never says that somebody who's ungodly, remember we talked about those people, the ungodly or the sinners, can't be good people. It's never the contention of the Bible. This is what Paul says. This is Romans 2, and we're going to be in verse 14. For when Gentiles, non-believers, who do not have the law, by nature do the things in the law, these, although not having the law, are a law to themselves, who show the works of the law written in their hearts, their conscience also bearing witness, and between themselves their thoughts accusing or else excusing them. What's Paul saying? God did not need to write down laws of thou shalt not murder on a stone tablet one time back in BC 2500 for humanity to know that murdering was a bad thing. We already knew it was a bad thing. The law just held you accountable before God. So what Paul's saying is that atheists could keep the law. Hindus could keep the law. Buddhists could keep the law. Jehovah's Witnesses could keep the law. All these people could keep the law. But their reason for keeping the law is not a relational reason. It's not a relational reason so that it won't be their delight. Okay, here's what I mean. If it's not a relational law, it cannot delight you. The laws that the government gives me do not delight me. I don't sit up at night and I read the DMV manual for what I can do on the road and say, oh, thank God that these rules exist. And I call up my local counselor and I'm like, oh my gosh, I'm so thankful for you that you made these laws for the road. You're amazing. You're the best, man. Can I send you a fruit basket? I want to just get to know you and be your friend. I never do that. Why? Because I don't have a relationship with the law. It's not a relational law. It's a governmental law. When I'm driving on the road, I'm not thankful for the speed limit. I'm like, oh, praise God for the speed limit. This is beautiful and amazing. I never do that. Because it's not a relational law. It doesn't build greater, deeper intimacy. I can't delight in the law. I may appreciate the law. I'm like, man, I'm kind of glad that the I-10 isn't like the Autobahn. That would be kind of crazy, you know, and everyone could just go whatever speed limit they think is right. You know, I'm kind of glad for that. But I don't delight in it. It's not a joy to me. I do delight in doing the things that please my wife, though. Why? Because I love her. Does that make sense to you guys? If love is the reason for keeping the law, it will lead to delight. If love is not the reason for keeping the law, it will lead to feeling restricted and pressed down. Okay, so atheists keep the law, but to them it's just a law. To them it's just, you just shouldn't. So it's a bummer to them. It's kind of weird to them. One philosopher put it this way, I love it. It's one of my favorite quotes ever. He says, men have evolved from apes, therefore, let us love one another. What's his point? If we evolve from apes, why the heck would we love one another? There's no reason for it. There's no foundation for why I would do it. I may do it, but it doesn't mean that I like doing it. It doesn't mean I delight in doing it. Okay? If you ask any other religion, hey, why do you do these things? If I ask a Hindu, why do you do good things? Why do you do that? You know what they would say to you? They wouldn't be like, oh man, I just love the pagan gods of the Hindu religion. The pantheon of gods are just so beautiful. And I love them so much, and that's why I keep their laws. No, why are they keeping their laws? I want to go to Nirvana one day. I want to wipe away my karmic code. You know, and I want to become in delight in heaven and all these things. That's why I do it, duh. It's not because it's enjoyable. It actually really sucks. But, you know, I'll do it anyway because I know this is how I get to heaven. If I go up to a Buddhist or a Mormon or Jehovah's Witness and I ask him, hey, why do you keep the law? He's going to say much the same thing. Hey, man, I don't want to. But I know I have to if I want to go to heaven. If I ask an atheist, hey, why do you love your wife? Well, I don't want to, but, you know, I know that to progress our species and to keep them going, I know I have to do it. You know, I'll suck it up and I'll do what I don't want to do and I'll do it. You know, it's always a bummer for them. It's always a bummer for them because they don't have a relationship. For a Christian, it's totally different. It's completely different for a Christian because Jesus, God, became a man. He dwelt among us. We beheld his glory as that of the only begotten of the Father. We were able to see him, touch him, feel him, talk to him, hang out with him. For a Christian, when we get into a relationship with God, it's literally, genuinely, a relationship. We can talk to him. We can have a relationship with him. He loves us. We love him. It's absolutely an incredibly beautiful thing. And because of that, we could delight to do the right things. It's a joy to do the right things. Now let's use the example of a marriage again. What if, at some point today, Emma asked me, hey Peter, why don't you have sex with other girls? I'm like, you know why? Because the law tells me no. And I really want to, but the law of Arizona says I can't do it. And it sucks, but I'll do it. I guess I will, you know, because the law tells me. Is that what I say? How would that conversation go? No. What's the correct answer? I love you. I love being in a relationship with you. Why would I want to go with another girl? You're awesome. You're amazing. You're incredible. You're beautiful. You're awesome. You see, that's the reason. The reason is love. Paul in 2 Corinthians 5, he says, the love of Christ compels us. So for a Christian, if someone comes up to you and says, I really hope and pray that you guys aren't continuing this false view of Christianity that we keep the law because we're supposed to or because we'll go to heaven one day. That's not why you keep the law. Paul says, the love of Christ compels us. I hope you'll tell them, you know why I keep the law? Because I genuinely love God. He's awesome. He's amazing. He's for me. He's with me. He's the best, most encouraging, most enjoyable, most satisfying being in the entire universe. How could I not keep his law? Does that make sense? You see how that changes how people view God, if I put it that way? as opposed to, well, I don't want to go to hell. That would suck. You know, that would be terrible. That's not the reason why. The reason why is because I love God. I want a relationship with Him. He's beautiful. He's awesome. And another cool thing about this is that relational constraint is the only type of constraint that doesn't feel demanding. It doesn't feel demanding. And it doesn't feel dehumanizing either. I'm assuming at some point you guys have had, maybe some of you, have had a relationship that really sucked. Right? A relationship that just ended so badly. And normally, when you have a relationship that ends so badly, the reason why it ends badly is because you chose to sacrifice, you chose to serve, you chose to love and be faithful to someone, and they chose not to. Right? Does that happen to any of you guys? Doesn't that feel dehumanizing? Feel used? You're like, man, I served, and I loved this girl, and I did all these things for her, and she wasn't faithful to me, and she didn't care, and she just left me. You feel a little used. You feel a little worn out. Because of that. Now here's the reason. That's not a loving relationship. That's a one-sided relationship. It's not a delight to keep those laws. It's not a delight to be like, man, I do this and this and this for her because I know I love her. You do all the things that you do is because you don't want them to break up with you, and then they break up with you anyway. It's terrible. One-sided relationships always end in a dehumanizing feeling. Now a lot of people would have that problem with God. Say, how can you delight in the law of God? How can you delight in that thing? God is just in heaven, man, and He gives you a list of commandments, and He says, follow them and I'll have a relationship with you. Isn't that dehumanizing? Isn't that the same deal? God's up in heaven. He doesn't change for you. He doesn't do anything for you. You have to do for Him, and then He'll have a relationship with you. That's terrible. That's dehumanizing. Now, how does a Christian respond to that? We say, well, we serve the only God who sacrificed for us. See, when a Christian studies the law, the most beautiful thing about the law, I have this quote from Deuteronomy 30, if you want to put it up. All right. Deuteronomy 30, this is like Moses' last sermon. So after he gives the law, he gives this kind of last sermon. And Moses was probably the worst inspirational speaker of all time. Because most inspirational speakers, when they finish a sermon, they're like, man, you know, here are the commandments of God, and you can do it if you try. You know what Moses says at the end of his sermon? Here are the commandments of God, and I know you're going to fail. That's what he says, like legitimately. Here are the blessings, here are the cursings. You guys are going to fail. I know it. It's already written. You know, you're going to blow it. There's no way you can keep these things. You suck. And that's the end. That's the end of his sermon. He ends it. And this is Deuteronomy 30, verse 15. See, I have set before you today life and good, death and evil, in that I command you today to love the Lord your God, to walk in His ways, and to keep His commandments, His statutes, and His judgments, that you may live and multiply, and the Lord your God will bless you in the land which you will go to possess. But if your heart turns away, so that you do not hear, and are drawn away, and worship other gods, and serve them, I announce to you today that you shall surely perish. You shall not prolong your days in the land which you cross over the Jordan to go in and possess. I call heaven and earth as witness against you today, that I have set before you life and death, blessing and cursing. Therefore choose life, that both you and your descendants may live, that they may obey the Lord your God, that you may obey His voice, and that you may cling to Him, for He is your life and the length of your days, and that you may dwell in the land which the Lord swore to your fathers, to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, to give to them. So in this one, he lays out the blessings and cursings, and in other places, he definitely says, you guys are going to inherit the cursings. You guys are going to blow it. You guys are going to be terrible. You are going to be thrown out of the land. That's exactly what he says to them, which is terrifying. So as a Christian, when I read the laws, here's the next wrong thing that can happen to me. Once again, I could look at it as in a dehumanizing way, because I see, first of all, I have to do all these things in order to have a relationship with God. And then the second thing that becomes dehumanizing is I realize I could never do it. Right? Have you guys ever read through the Sermon on the Mount? And where Jesus says, even if you get angry at someone, you've already committed murder. Even if you look at someone and you say, man, she's hot. Bam, you committed adultery. You know, any amount of sin that happens inside of your heart, it expounds out and it's a sin. You failed the law. I don't know anyone on this planet that could read through the Sermon on the Mount and be like, nailed it, did it all my life. You know, I've never done any of those things. There's no way. When you read the law, you're automatically put in this place of feeling like crap. First of all, God never sacrifices for me. And second of all, I can't even live up to His standards. It's unrealistic that I could live up to the standards of God. So how does a Christian answer that? Here's how a Christian answers that. In the person of Jesus Christ. In the person of Jesus Christ, we have a God who, first of all, does not sit up in heaven and say, hey, you adjust to me. We have a God in heaven, the ultimate free being, the ultimate beautiful being, the ultimate being who does not have to sacrifice or give anything up. He comes down, becomes a man, dwells among us, lives under the curse of the law. He lives under the curse of the law. He has all the requirements of the law hoisted upon him. He fulfills it perfectly. The only possible man that could look at God and say, you owe me a relationship. He gives up his perfection. He dies on a cross. It says in 2 Corinthians 5, he who knew no sin became sin that we might become the righteousness of God in him. So you have this ultimate God who becomes a man, endures the curse of the sin and curse of the law, and dies for you. That answers both the objections. First of all, I do not serve a God who does not serve me or live for me or sacrifice for me. I serve a God who did the ultimate sacrifice for me. You know, if I looked at Emma and I said, you know what, I don't really think that you love me, and then she died for me, I would not stand outside her grave and be like, I'm still not sure if you love me. You know, I just don't know. You know, could you do a little more for me so I could really see if you love? There's no higher than that. If someone dies for you, that is the highest expression of love that they could ever possibly do for you. Jesus died for you. Of course he loves you. Of course he cares for you. He already did the sacrificing part. All he asks from you is that you put your faith in him. Here's the other beautiful thing. As I focus on the law of the Lord, and I see I can't do it, I can't do it, I cannot complete this, what it inevitably always does to me is it leads me back to the cross and I give thanksgiving or praise to God. So that answers the question, why are the Psalms filled with praise? Why is it all about praising God? Why is it all about worshiping God? Here's why. Worship is the natural expression of joy that happens in a human being. It just happens. You don't think about it. You just do it. Right? If one of you saw a really awesome movie, you know, last week or something like that, you wouldn't come in here and be like, oh, I should remember to tell everyone how awesome that movie is. I really need to, I don't want to, but you know, I really should do it. It just comes out naturally. Man, you should see this movie. It's awesome. It's the best movie ever. Why? Worship is a natural expression of joy. It happens without thinking. Why are the psalmists worshiping God? Because it's a natural expression of joy. They can't help it. They see God's mercy. They see God's love. They see God's grace. And they can't help but worship him. It's a natural expression of their joy. So when I go and I see the law that I can't complete, and I see it put and hoisted upon Jesus, the only one who could complete it, my natural expression to that is praise. I can't help it. It comes out. It flows out of me. I'm not forced to. Nobody like holds me down. You're going to worship the Lord and you're going to like it. I want to. It comes out naturally. Just like nobody has to tell me, you're going to tell Emma that she's beautiful and awesome. You're going to do it. No, I don't. It just comes out. It just happens. Why? Because I genuinely love and I care about her. The joy of Christ always ends up in the praise of his name. So if you look at your life and you see, I don't really praise God that much, which is fine. You look at your life and say, I don't really see a lot of my life as being praising God. You know why you're not spending a lot of time praising God? Maybe it's because your delight is not in the law of the Lord. You're not finding joy in focusing on the law of the Lord and seeing how Christ fulfilled it. You're not seeing constantly how much Jesus did for you. See? It happens naturally if you truly understand it. Now, I know a lot of you don't own houses. But none of you own houses. But imagine, further on down the road, you own a house, okay? And let's say you go out of town and you ask one of your best friends, like, hey, man, can you watch my house for me? I'm going to be out of town for a while. And they're like, yeah, sure, don't worry about it, dude. I got you. And you leave town for a couple months. You come back. You're like, how'd it go? Oh, it went great, man. Just one thing. You did have a bill come in the mail, but I took care of it for you. All right, later. And he leaves. Now, the next logical question that you should ask is, how much was it for? Right? Because if it was the bill for an overdue library book and it was 15 cents or something like that, you'd be like, thanks. You know, it's kind of a blessing. You know, save me a trip to the post office. Thank you. You know, but it really wouldn't merit that much praise. But if he comes back to you and he says, oh, by the way, it was a red light cam. It was $350. But don't worry about it, I took care of it. That's all the difference in the world between me just saying, hey, thanks, and me being like, oh my gosh, you're like the best friend ever. Dude, thank you so much. Is there anything I could do for you? That's incredible, dude. Thank you. You see? Or if it was something higher than that, what if it was a price that you could never pay? What if the IRS sent you a bill and said, hey, by the way, you know, we've totally messed up your taxes. You owed like 5 years of back taxes equals $200,000. There you go. And the guy paid that. That's like, oh my gosh, dude, you just literally saved my life. I would have never been able to pay that back. You're incredible. You see, the level of service demands the level of praise. If you don't praise God that much, the reason is because you don't recognize what he did for you. Jesus put it this way in Luke chapter 7. He's hanging out in a house with this guy who's a Pharisee. And a woman comes to him and he falls on his feet. She cries and weeps over his feet. She wipes his feet with her hair. She pours fragrant oil over it. And Simon looks at it. He's like, ugh, that's gross. You know, nasty. The woman's a sinner. Jesus is like, hey man, I got a story for you. There's two guys. They each owe money to another dude. One owes $1 billion. The other one owes him like 5,000 bucks. Forgives both of them. Who would love him more? He says, well, I suppose the one he forgave more. He says, dude, right on. He who is forgiven much loves much. He who is forgiven little, the same loves little. See, if you want your relationship with God to be truly beautiful, overflowing with praise, you got to spend time in the law. You got to spend time understanding what Jesus has done for you. Not only do you need to spend time in the law, but you need to understand exactly where you've broken. In Psalm 139, one of the expressions of praise that a psalmist gives is he says, if there's any wicked way in me, Lord, reveal it. If there's any wicked way in me, Lord, please reveal it to me. I want to know. I want to know exactly where I'm blowing it. I want to know exactly how I'm falling short. Now, we don't do that as Christians. I don't get on my knees before God and say, God, show me any wicked way that is in me because I'm like a weird, you guys know what a masochist is? Someone who likes pain. I'm not a masochist. I don't like pain. The reason why I do that is because I want, first of all, God to show me his love for me in the sacrifice of the cross that I don't really fully understand. And if I want to fully understand it, I need to know fully how much I need it. Jesus says, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Do you understand how poor you are before the Lord? How much you need him? That'll automatically express itself in praise. The second thing that it will do to you is the next part. In his law he meditates day and night, and he shall be like a tree planted by rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, and whose leaf shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. I don't have time. I thought I had time, but I don't have time. I put a couple quotes up there. This is not the only time that the Bible equates you to a tree. It does it in Jeremiah chapter 17, John chapter 15, and Galatians chapter 5. Okay, so four times, at least, that I know of, there's probably more, four times at least that the Bible equates you to a tree. That's not a compliment. If I looked at someone and I said, you know, you're such a good worker, you're like a tree, man. You're like a tree. You know, I'd be like, dude, that's kind of not a good compliment at all. Why? Because what do trees do? Nothing. They just sit there and they just suck in nutrients like a bunch of selfish things. You know, they don't do anything. They don't provide for anyone. They just sit there. Yeah, see, basically, trees are like teenagers. they just suck in stuff and they don't produce, they don't help anyone out. You see, when God looks at us and he says, you're like a tree, man, he's not saying you're firm, you're solid. That's not what he's saying. He's saying you're incapable of nothing. Jesus actually, he specifies this in John chapter 15 where he calls us trees. He says, I'm the vine, you're the branches. If you abide in me, you do much. He says, but apart from me, you can do what? Nothing. Don't even try. You're terrible. You can't do it. You can't satisfy me. You can't do the right thing. You cannot fulfill the law in your own strength. That's what he's saying to you. So my meditation on the law, here's what it's going to do to me. It's going to bring me to the end of my strength. You will never, if you're like me, okay, I'm a very stubborn guy, I will never ask for help unless I absolutely need it. I will never, ever, ever ask for help until I get to the end of myself. At one camp, this one pastor, he said, you know, a lot of people, when they look through the Bible, they're like, man, I think I'm kind of like David, you know, in a lot of things I do. I think I'm like the Apostle Paul. Everyone picks out someone that's great and mighty when they say I'm like this person in the Bible. And he's like, I think I'm like Jacob. And listening to it, I'm like, yeah, I think I'm like Jacob too. Here's what Jacob was like. Jacob was a dude who was always, what'd you say? He was a conniver. He was a conniver. He was always trying to get one up on people. He was always trying to trick people. If you remember, he tricked his brother Esau with a bowl of soup. He says, hey, give me your birthright. I'll give you this bowl of soup. And he stole his birthright. Later on, he tricked him again. He put on hair on his arms to pretend like he was his brother Esau so that his father would give him the birthright again. He was always trying to trick people. He was always trying to one-up on people. And he one-upped his brother so many times. His brother, it says at one point, one of my favorite parts in the Bible, it says his brother comforted himself with thoughts of killing him. And I like that part. I'm like, yeah, you know, like that, I can understand that. You know, if you guys have siblings, you might understand that. You know, like it's like, you're just like, man, I'm just so angry at this person. You comfort yourself with thoughts of killing them. You're like, yes, you know, there will be justice one day. And so Jacob, he runs away. And finally God says, you know what? I want you to go back to your brother. I want you to go back home. It's time, man. Jacob's like, okay. And God's like, hey, don't worry about it. I'm going to protect you. I got you, man. Don't worry about it. So Jacob's like, okay, I have faith. I know God's going to protect me. And he's going home. And then he hears that Esau's coming with 400 guys. And he goes, oh my gosh. So he starts sending gifts. He's like, oh, just send a bunch of lambs at him. Maybe he'll forgive me because of that. And Esau receives all the lambs. And then God comes to Jacob that night and he says, hey, dude, don't worry about it. I got you. Don't worry. He's not going to hurt you. I'm going to protect you. Don't worry about it. And Jacob's like, I totally believe you. The next day, oh my gosh, I'm going to die. And, you know, he sends more gifts. He's like, man, I'm going to send him more gifts. And then that night, again, God comes to him. He's like, don't worry, man. I got you. I got you. Don't worry about it. He's not going to touch you, man. You don't have to send him any more gifts. You don't have to do anything. I'm going to protect you myself. And Jacob's like, okay, I totally trust you. Next day, oh my gosh, you know, and he splits his camp. He's like, okay, at least if he attacks one camp, I can get away. You know, so he's still trying to connive. He's still trying to twist things. God comes to him one last time. He says, dude, don't worry about it. I got you. Stop trying to protect yourself. I'm going to protect you. Don't worry about it. He's like, I totally believe you. Then he's like, okay, I don't believe you. And so he runs off in the wilderness by himself. And he's like, you know what? At least he'll just kill me. He won't kill any of my friends. He won't kill any of my family. It'll just be me that dies. Then God shows him to him one more time. And you know what Jacob does? God comes down from heaven. God comes down from heaven, stares at Jacob face to face. You know what Jacob does? He wrestles him. Most people would fall on their face. Oh my gosh, God, you're awesome. You're amazing. What is Jacob? You got to bless me. And he gets him in a chokehold and he tries to wrestle him. And God's like, dude, if you want to wrestle me, fine, let's go. So God wrestles him all night. In the morning, he's like, dude, I got to go. Jacob's like, no, you can't go yet. And so he just touches his hip and his hip goes out of socket. And now Jacob's finally in a place where he can't scheme anymore. He can't run because his hip's out of place. He can't fight because his hip's out of place. He has no more goods. He has no more family to protect him. He is finally at the place where he has no other options but to trust in God. And it says in Hosea that he sought protection with tears. So he finally gets on his knees. He hugs God and he says, I will not let you go until you bless me. Jacob finally gets it. If God doesn't bless me here, I'm done. I'm done. You see, in my life, that's what it looks like. God says, hey, I'm going to be with you. I'm going to deliver you. I'm going to be for you, man, no matter what. And I'm like, yeah, I totally believe you. And then I sin. I'm like, oh, I don't believe you. I'm such a wicked sinner. I'm terrible. You don't love me. You know, and I freak out. Right? And then the next day, God's like, hey, dude, no, seriously, I love you. I care for you. I'm going to help you. You know, I've begun a good work in you. I'm going to be faithful to complete. You could trust me. I'm like, I totally believe you. And then the next night I fall. And I'm like, oh my gosh, everything's going wrong. God has abandoned me. You know, and I freak out again. You see, that's my cycle. And it happened over and over and over again until finally I got to the point where I was like, you know what, God, if you don't bless me, I'm done. If you don't protect me, if you're not here with me in this one place, if you don't set me free from this sin, I will never be set free. See, that was the final point where God broke my hip and I realized I need to trust him. And it was only after that I started seeing any amount of victory in my life in regards to my sin of pornography. It was only after that moment that I finally saw any amount of victory in my life. Why? God was getting me to the place where he's like, you need to trust me, man. I'm for you. I love you. I care for you. And I didn't accept it. I didn't believe it. You see? But when I was confronted with the law, it forced me to trust. Right? It forced me to trust. It forced me to actually grow. See, as a Christian, you can manufacture growth. Right? Imagine if you got a tree that sucks and it doesn't have any fruit. I'm like, you know what? I'm going to fix this. I'm going to go out to Costco. I'm going to buy fruit. And I'm going to duct tape it to my tree. You know, and I'm going to make it look good. I'm going to make it look amazing. You know, and everyone goes by, man, that's a fruitful tree. You know, that's amazing. What's going to happen to that fruit? It's going to die. It's going to rot. It's not organic to the tree. It didn't grow out of the tree. It was just put on there. So many Christians are so obsessed with making their lives look good that they never actually grow. Does that make sense to you guys? We call them hypocrites, false faces. People who act holy, but actually aren't. You don't want to be like that. You want to be someone who actually is holy. Someone who organically has grown in Jesus. Notice what he says. He will be like a tree planted in rivers of water that bring forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. You want to be prosperous? You want to grow? You want to have fruit come out of your life? It comes from rooting yourself in Jesus, saying, I can't do anything of myself. I need you. And you don't get there unless you study the law. You don't get there unless you study the law. Everything else you can kind of get a one up on people, right? Your job, your school, your everything. And you can always get one up on people. The law is the one thing that's going to bring you to your knees, because you're going to realize just how incapable you are of keeping that thing. It's the one thing that's finally going to get you to the place where you trust God. You got to meditate on the law, and that's going to cause genuine growth. And notice what it says, your leaf won't wither. Meaning, you're not going to go, like, so many of us, if you look at Christians, let me put it this way. If you look at Christians that are on fire one second, and then they're dead in the water the next second, that's what this is talking about, people who wither, right? One second they're just like on fire for the Lord, man, I'm going to go after God with everything in my life, man, I'm totally sold out for God, for Jesus, it's amazing, he's beautiful. And then a month later, they're just on their face. You're like, dude, how you doing? I'm terrible. This is horrible. I don't even know if there's a God. You're just like, dude, what happened to you? They withered. Why? Because the growth wasn't organic. They weren't trusting God. They were just making themselves look righteous. They were just trying to, in their own strength, become righteous. See, they wither. They don't make it. Only the Christian who's rooted in Jesus, who's trusting in Jesus, he's the person who won't wither. He gets knocked over, he gets right back up. Right? If I fell to pornography tonight, it would suck. It would be terrible. I would hate it. But it wouldn't make me wither. Because I realize any amount of growth that I have in my life right now is attributed to God alone. His grace is the only thing that has gotten me this far. So if I fall tonight, well, no duh, I suck. You know? But God is in me, and he's going to work through me, and he's going to benefit me, and he's going to grow me. See, my trust is in him. It's not in anything else on this earth. If you want to be a Christian who doesn't wither, you got to be one who is rooted in God. And you become rooted in God by studying his word, by studying his law. Okay, he says, the ungodly are not so. They are like chaff that the wind drives away. Okay, the idea of chaff is like it's like fake fruit. You know, when you had wheat, you had the wheat and the chaff. Okay, so you had the actual grains of wheat that were good and edible and everything like that, but the chaff was around it. So in order to get it, you'd have to kind of shake it or throw it in the air, and then the chaff would blow away, but the wheat would remain. See, and that's what the ungodly are like. They may look godly at some points. They may be surrounded by godly things. They may even be attached to godly things. They may be in the church. They may be hanging out with you guys. They may seem pretty godly. But he says, but they're like chaff. They blow away. There's nothing substantial about them. They're just going to blow away. They're going to be done. Therefore, the ungodly will not stand in judgment, nor sinners in the congregation of the righteous. This is looking forward. This is what we call in the Christian life confidence. We call it confidence. If you were to die right now, how confident are you that you would stand in the day of judgment? When an all-holy, all-perfect, all-powerful, all-amazing God looks at you with eyes like a flame of fire, sees everything that you've done, thought about doing, everything that you didn't do, what makes you think that that God, what gives you confidence that that God is going to say, hey, come right in. Come on in. I love you. I cherish you. What's your confidence? If you're like the ungodly put their strength in this. If I were to ask an ungodly person today, if I were to ask an atheist, hey man, do you think if there's a judgment at the end of the days, do you think you'd make it into heaven? Most of them would say, yeah. Now, what would their reason be? Why do you think that? What would they say to me? I'm a good person, right? I do good things. That would be their reasoning. What the psalmist is saying, dude, they're like chaff. They're going to be blown away. They're going to be destroyed in the day of judgment. Because no one can stand before God. No one can stand before God. He's holy. He's awesome. He's righteous. See, for me as a Christian, you know my only confidence is? I put my faith in what the Son of God did for me. That's it. That's my confidence. Jesus died for me on the cross. He took my sin. He took my shame. He took everything that belonged to me. And He gave me His righteousness. He who knew no sin became sin that I might become the righteousness of God. I've become the righteousness of God through my faith in the Son. That's it. That's my confidence. If you want confidence in your Christian life, put your faith in what Jesus did. If you want to be wishy-washy and freaked out all the time, put your faith in what you do. You're always going to feel inadequate. You're always going to feel like I'm not doing enough. But if you put your faith in Jesus, you're going to feel pretty confident in the day of judgment. This is another beautiful thing. Confidence in God is just like confidence in a relationship. I've never really seen anyone freak out about a human relationship. Like, let's say they're dating a girl or something like that. I've never really seen them freak out in a human relationship if things are going great. You know, if they're going out on dates and they're having good times and they're loving one another and they're taking care of one another and they're talking and having fun and growing and walk together and loving one another. I've never seen anyone like that be like, oh man, I think she's going to dump me like tomorrow. Like what makes you think that? Well, we had such a great time today. You know, it was so amazing. You know, we told each other that we love each other like 5 times and then I took her on a date and then she hugged me and it was amazing. That's why you think that she's going to dump you? That doesn't make any sense. But on the flip side, if I talk to someone, he's like, hey man, I think my girlfriend's going to dump me. Well, what makes you think that? Well, I haven't talked to her in like 2 weeks. And the last time I did talk to her, I made fun of her. And by the way, I cheated on her. I'd be like, yeah, you probably don't have a lot of confidence in that relationship. You know, she probably will dump you. You know, that probably is going to end. You see, someone who has confidence is someone who's growing in love. Someone who has no confidence is the person who's like, I don't really know. And so many Christians are like that. What kind of confidence do you have in Jesus? Well, I got a little confidence. What makes you think He might not let you in? Well, I haven't talked to Him in 6 years. And, you know, the last time I went to church was when I got baptized. And I haven't really opened His Bible, like, ever. And I spend my life in habitual sin. So I don't know how my relationship with God is doing. I'd be like, yeah, you may want to work on that. You know, you may want to do something about that because that doesn't sound good. You shouldn't have confidence that that's what your life is like. But if you have a loving relationship with God, you have all the confidence in the world. All the confidence in the world that He's going to let you in. Because you understand it's not on works of righteousness, but it's on faith alone in Jesus Christ. And that faith, as James says, that faith works. That faith produces fruit. That faith produces relationship with Jesus. Okay, so I'm going to end this with this. When we're thinking about growing in a relationship with Jesus, what do we need to do? Yeah, I mentioned one thing, you need to focus on the law of God, but let me just bring it down to a really simple thing. Think about how you grow in a relationship with anyone. Okay, how do you grow in a relationship with someone that you like, that you want to be with? Well, if you want to grow in a relationship, you got to spend time with them, right? That's just no-brainer. You can't like look at someone that you have a crush on and be like, man, I like them so much. What are you going to do about it? Well, I'm just going to, you know, play it cool, not talk to them ever, and then I just assume that they'll just love me one day, you know? It doesn't work, right? You're going to hang around them. You're going to talk to them. You're going to start learning about them. Start praising them. You're going to start doing things for them, right? That's the only way. Now let's put this in a relationship with God. You want to grow in your love with God? You got to hang out with the guy. You got to hang out with him. Okay, you got to pray to him. That's talking. Praying is just talking to God. You need to talk to him. You need to be where he is. That's why we encourage you guys to go to church. You go to church, you get to spend time with believers, you get to spend time with people who love God and enjoy God, and it's going to encourage you in your walk with God. See, you get to hear from the Word of God. It's going to encourage you in your walk with God. That's why we tell you guys you should come to church. It's going to help you. It's going to grow you. Okay, you need to learn about Him. That means you got to open up your Bible and read. It sucks, but John Piper put it this way. God did not inspire a movie, as much as we would like that. God did not inspire a video game. He inspired a book. This means I got to read it. I got to read it every now and then. I got to open it up. I need to see what it says about Him. Okay, I need to praise Him. Okay, and this is another way to understand worship. Not only is worship the spontaneous overflow of joy, which I hope you guys understand. So as I enjoy God, I will spontaneously, I will just naturally thank Him, love Him, and praise Him. That comes with it. But the second thing, this really helped me out. Did you guys know the word worship in your Bible is sometimes translated serve? Do you know that? Serve and worship, the same word. It's translated both ways. That really helped me. Worshiping God doesn't just happen when we sit here and we sing praise and worship songs. That's not when it happens. It happens when I serve Him. Are you spending time serving Jesus? Are you doing things? Are you working on the sin in your life? Are you trying to be more like Him? Are you seeking Him? Are you following Him? Are you loving Him? Are you doing things for Him? You see, service doesn't produce love, but love certainly produces service. See, the beginning of it is love, but love will always lead to service, wanting to serve. So that's why we serve. That's why we serve. Like I said, that love is the only thing that when you actually serve, it doesn't feel constraining or limiting. It feels freeing. He says in verse 6, "For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the ungodly shall perish." So when it says that God knows the way of the righteous, it means that He's with you. He knows your way. He knows your path. He knows where you're going. He's going to take care of you. He's going to watch over you. He's going to benefit you. But the way of the ungodly shall perish. No matter how pleasurable sin can be, the end is always destruction. Right? And like I said, this world is discovering that. Yeah, this world is discovering that. The more and more that we discover about this, our sin and the things that we do, the more we're discovering that sin doesn't lead to anything but destruction, eventually. Could be fun for a season, but it ultimately leads to destruction. And this is one last thing that you guys need to think about. Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, he says, "When I was a child, I thought like a child, I acted like a child, I reasoned as a child. But now that I'm grown, I put away childish things." Now, there's so many things I could say about that verse, but here's the number one thing. Kids don't think about the future. They're really, really short-sighted. If I went up to a kid and I said, "Hey, man, you want some chocolate?" He's not going to be like, "Whoa, dude, I'm watching my calorie intake. You know, I'm thinking about becoming a football star one day. I don't want to, you know, put too much sugar in the system." You know, no kid's going to say that. Why? Because they don't think long-term. They don't think long-term. As you grow up, you start thinking long-term. You start thinking on five-year plans. See, when I talk to an elementary school kid, I'm like, "Hey, man, how are you doing in school?" "Well, you know, I'm doing all right. You know, I get some good grades." "Dude, aren't you worried about what college you're going to make it into?" No elementary school kid's thinking that way. Why? Because they don't think long-term. But when you get in high school, you start thinking that way. Like, "Man, I better ship up or else I'm not going to make it anything but Pima." You know, you start thinking that way. Why? Because it starts to matter. You start thinking long-term. You're growing up. You're putting away childish things. See, as a Christian, you need to grow up. You need to stop thinking about the immediate gratification of sin, and you need to start thinking about the long-term effects. And you need to start thinking about the long-term effects of God, too. See, we need to put away childish things. You want to grow up. You want to mature. That's what being a Christian is about. It's about maturing, understanding, hey, yeah, this will satisfy me for a second, but long-term it's going to ruin my life. So I'm going to abstain. All right, so start thinking of mature things, as we would say it. All right, so let's pray, and that'll be it. Dear God, I thank You so much for Your word. I pray that we would be people that would delight in You. God, delight in Your law, that we remember what Your Son did for us. God, that we would rejoice in that. We would praise You for that. God, we would learn to walk with You, to love You more and more each day. God, and in Your name, amen.